Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. You have to believe in the power of you. Uncomfortable is where the change is. You have to be willing to question the impossible, or you're planning for the inevitable. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you are living your Cognitive Rampage. We are brought to you by Vermont Pure CBD Full Spectrum Wellness Products. Now, if you listen to last podcast, Grant Jacobowski was on the podcast, the founder of that. So if you haven't heard that, I suggest you go back and listen to that podcast. It was Cognitive Rampage 220. He basically told you everything you need to know, and even then some, about CBD and Vermont Pure CBD Full Wellness Products Company. A beautiful company. We got deep into it. But just for the top for you now, look, they grow all their hemp on organic Vermont farmland. That matters. It certainly matters to me. They focus on high CBD and terpene-rich varieties that provide maximum healing benefits. They extract all hemp using high-tech alcohol extraction, not that dangerous butane stuff. They produce the highest quality full-spectrum CBD available. They control the entire process to ensure that they produce the best CBD products on the market. Now, full spectrum, just so you understand it, if you didn't listen to that podcast, means it still contains some THC, but not enough to where it's going to affect you psychoactively. But there are healing properties to the THC, okay? There's isolates that are out there, all right? But when they isolate it like that, it removes some healing properties, some CBN, CBG, some things, again, that you should go back and listen to the podcast with Grant Jacobowski on 220. Go back and listen to that. So the reason full spectrum is more healing is because they leave the full properties in it. They don't pull those things out, all right? So isolates can certainly be helpful, but they're not near as strong medically as a full spectrum product, okay? Especially the fact that it's organic. It's grown on organic farmland, to be specific, okay? So I use this product too. Again, I would not sell or endorse anything I have not used. Do not recommend at all. I wouldn't be doing that at all. So we got to try it out. It has done some wonderful things for me. I don't use it every day. But when I do, it works, whether it's a small ache or pain or something like that. And it's done wonders for psoriasis for myself as well. That runs in my family. It's a gene that's passed down, but, well, no more. So it's amazing the things that you can treat with CBD, especially a full spectrum. Just go to VermontPureCBD.com, enter the promo code Rampage, and you get 10% off. Okay, that's VermontPureCBD.com. Enter code word Rampage for 10% off. And this podcast is also fueled by my book, The Cognitive Rampage, which you can find available now on Amazon. The second edition is out. You can look that up. I'd love to go deep into it, but I've done a ton of podcasts on my actual book. But it's about life change, self-discovery, and, well, getting deep in your own life. And look, you don't have to be at rock bottom. I don't like to classify my book as a self-help book because it's also a self-optimization book, because that's also who it's for. Look, if you're on rock bottom dealing with addiction, depression, anxiety, I promise you this book is for you. It will pull you out of that hole, or at least assist you, right? Because it will be you that pulls you out of that hole. But even if not, if you just like life development, life optimization, learning more about yourself, self-discovery, trying new things, well, and if you don't know what your life philosophy is, right? A lot of people don't know what their actual life philosophy is. Not that quote you keep using and claim to be your life philosophy, right? This book, it's an experience. I'm telling you, it's not just this self-help book filled with motivational fluff and words telling you that a boy, you can do it, right? And just change how you think, right? It's different. It's deeper. It's based in multiple sciences, from the biology down to sociology, cognitive sciences, behavioral sciences, environmental sciences, and working in nature, sleep, all these things that we know to be necessary too. And it's all put together in a self-application for you. You apply it to yourself, and there is no harmful side effects, all right? promise you that at least, right? So pick up that book. You can go to Amazon. Just type in The Cognitive Rampage, basically anywhere on Google. Not too many things named The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find that book. And we are live. Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you are living your Cognitive Rampage. Well, I'm excited. I got my running gear on already for this podcast. So we got one in this morning. So we'll be doing one probably after this one. But I'm excited to have, well, it's always awkward when I do the intro and they're already here ready to do the show and I'm talking like they're not in the show. So I'll just say it's Dr. William Pullen, author of Run for Your Life and the founder of Dynamic Running Therapy. Welcome to the show, William.
Well, it's fantastic to be here. Can I just point out quickly that actually technically I'm not a doctor, but does that matter?
No, I don't think it does. And actually nowadays it kind of hurts you. Yeah, I put two and two together hoping when I saw psychotherapy and psychotherapist on the back end. So
no, a lot of people make that mistake because I did an interview for Vogue once and they called me a doctor. And so that's had a long tail, but it's okay. You know, I don't mind being known as a doctor. I'm a healer of some sort.
Yeah, I'll take it. It's, you know, I wish somebody would confuse that with being a master mental health counselor. I was like, yeah, I'll take doctor too once in a while if you want to throw that out there.
Upgrade, yeah.
Seriously. But, you know, we almost had you on the show not long ago and got lost in the shuffle there. But I'm excited to have you on the show. Not only because, look, when people think about running in therapy, I hear people go, yeah, okay, of course. But it's so much deeper than that.
Yeah, I mean, how it works is a lot deeper than that. If you mean the actual process and what the running element adds to therapy, yeah, it's intense. You know, it's a massive sort of biofeedback area. And also, you'll know this. You know, when you do some exercise and you're feeling emotional, exercise actually makes you feel more emotional, doesn't it? Not afterwards. Afterwards, you feel less. But if you go out angry, you can actually end up getting a lot more angry or a lot sadder before you get better. And so it helps bring up feelings. That for me is a big part of it is and particularly for men, you know, I like to have male clients because it's harder for men to emote freely. So given an excuse, plus of course, we're not doing this with each other. We're not facing off. We're running side by side and that's a lot easier. Nobody wants to watch you. As a man, you don't want people watching you too closely while you get emotional. God forbid.
Well, if anyone's tuned into this podcast, I certainly am transparent. And I try to help by going, hey, this is my life. You know, this is what I'm experiencing and going through in hopes that, you know, other men or women will follow through and do that same thing. But, you know, before we get into the specifics of all this, I'd like to hear, well, how did you get here? How did you get to writing the book? What's the story of yourself? Well, that led you to write this.
Okay. The story of me. Briefly, I had a whole bunch of different careers up until about 37 or something like that, 38. Then I had a bit of a meltdown after a relationship went south and ended up depressed and it just in a terrible state. It was a lot more than just I think it was like a midlife crisis with a kind of, anyway, a whole bunch of stuff came together. And I took up running. I was more of a sort of poker player and a party boy than I was a therapist. Then I was a runner. But I took up therapy to try and help my head, found a therapist, and took up running, knowing that that would be good for my body, good for my mind. And then I ended up putting the two together, training. In my training, developing an approach, and then I got a book deal and a podcast and a TEDx, not a podcast, sorry, an app. That's it. So anyway, it's been a long and fantastic career. So far, I suppose it's not that long. It's 13 years or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, they fly by, man. I'm but episode 223 here on this podcast. And I was like, oh my God, I remember like 23, but you know, when you're coming out of, I'm guessing depression or anxiety after the, you know, a meltdown, as you describe it, for sure. Been there. And well, how, you know, because a lot of people aren't going to say, hey, I'm depressed, man. Last thing I want to do is put one foot in front of the other and run.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely a thing. But, you know, I would say about depression is that, you know, it's 20% chemical and it's 80% behavioral. You know, you and a lot of the behavioral stuff, the ideas that you have about yourself, those become embedded in your behaviors. It's much easier to change your behavior than it is to change the thoughts that you have about yourself. So I tell people, come into therapy. If they can't do the running piece, and by the way, a running session is 15 minutes long. It's completely run by the client in terms of who chooses the movement. It could be walking, sitting, and on average, I'd say it's 10 minutes of very slow running. So mostly I just want them to get up and get out. But you're right, you know, for depressed people, that's the toughest thing, is to get up and get out. So, you know, I recognize it's not for everybody. Perhaps it's for the people who are just that little bit further down the road. You know, it took me 6 months or a year, I can't even remember, to get to the point where I could have a therapist and even get outside properly and start trying to run. And that part was thanks to antidepressants. So I have to thank Big Pharma for some of my journey.
Yeah, well, that's all right. You know, for me, I'm, you know, when I started this, I came out pretty hardcore against all the Big Pharma stuff, only because, you know, I was treating people in addiction and seeing the trade-off there of what would happen. And so I came out really hardcore against it. I mean, when I was on Rogan's podcast, I really went at it with some generalizations, you know, I had some podcast remorse. But, you know, where I've kind of pulled myself to is like, look, if somersaults work for you, do that. You know, if the antidepressant works for you, try that. But just, you know, be aware of what you're walking into and keep a journal of your mind and your body, et cetera. So, you know, for me, I'm a fan of whatever works for you. I don't care if that's AA, NA, whatever it is, you know. And so I'm a fan of whatever works. And you mentioned something that I'm a huge, huge proponent of, is the idea that a lot of people use cognitive reframing or something like that, you know. And I've been through severe anxiety and depression myself. And when you're sitting there and you're going, okay, today's not going to be a shitty day, it's going to be a good day, you're like, oh, okay, it's a shitty day, right? You get through that moment, it can help for a second, maybe bring down the redlining, but you're so correct that the behavior actually can do more for you than the actual thought changing. And I mean, I tell people the way those thoughts got there is the behavior that you've been doing or not doing. And so to simply reframe, you're spitting on a fire. You know, but the idea that we can use behavior to begin to change our thoughts is so much stronger.
Well, for the purists over here, they'd say it's a chicken and egg thing. And, you know, there's the way it works in this country anyway, is you have those that practice behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and then you have those who are more classic, so supposedly like me, actually. I'm not trained. Well, I've done some training in CBT, but I'm more sort of humanistic. I'm more about looking at the choices that you make in your life, the relationships that you have, how you understand yourself, how you understand others. So that's less about advocating behavioral change. It's the CBT people that really take that position. What I try to do, as technically as an integrative therapy, is bring the two together. So I want to know what kind of terrible ideas you've got in your head about yourself, which, as you said, may have been put in there by the behaviors or reinforced by your behaviors or even put in there by other people's behaviors. Who knows? But let's talk about those. But let's also look at some behavioral changes so that we can come like a pincer approach.
Yeah, I think too many times I wrote about in my own book about how there's such a disconnect between the practitioners that choose, no, it's behavior, no, it's how you think, no, it's your environment, no, it's your genetics, no, it's your biology. It's yes. The answer for me was yes, it's all of those things. And if you tinker with a little bit of those all at once, you can kind of bring something together. And for me, what really caught reading about your book, et cetera, was it's not just running, that you're bringing in mindfulness practices, thought exercises, a little bit of psychotherapy just because it's client led. But you're mixing in those with this behavior that you're doing, which I thought was really fascinating because, you know, you're not laying on a couch with somebody saying, now, tell me how that makes you feel.
Do you know what's fantastic about it? Again, you know, it depends where people are in their depression or anxiety, whatever it is. But particularly with depression, right? Because depression is a kind of being stuck. It's a kind of powerlessness. It's a kind of believing that you're de-skilled, untooled, deplatformed, whatever term you would use. But guess what? If I can get from A to B, If I run with my clients, if they feel like crap, but they come out and they get from A to B, even if it's only 100 meters, that's something they achieved that day. It's a success. And if they do it the next day and they make it 120 meters and so forth, they now have gone from the person that can do nothing to the person who has an experience of not just achieving something, but being in control of that achievement and knowing that each week that we meet, they can do a little bit more. I mean, it's not about working out, obviously, that it's about psychotherapy, but that's a critical part of it, right? Competency. How many people in addiction are sitting around in AA rooms feeling less than, right? I'm not up to this job. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not. Well, if for a moment you can be the person who is good enough to get from A to B on a, you know, in a year that you haven't even been able to put your shoes on, that's a great thing. That's that shard of light coming in.
Oh, that's beautiful, man. I'm a avid diver and spear fisherman. And if people do that, they can understand the quote I use, which is even on the deepest dives, you have to look up to appreciate what you're really doing. And for the most part, you can put one foot in front of the other. You can walk, you know. And when I was going through, I had some serious trauma with PTSD issues and stuff. And for me, leaving the house became an issue, you know. I mean, really, and for me, that was weird. I was like, wait, what's happening? Even being a mental health practitioner, like, wait, well, this isn't supposed to happen, you know, and set small goals. Like, you know, I'd be walking or running and go, get there and you're fine. If you get there and you're still alive, guess what? You're fine. You know, yeah. Those little small goals of one foot in front of the other from A to B, I think is huge for other people that aren't there. They don't get that, but bringing that into the psychotherapy, the work, the mindfulness, I think is beautiful. And a lot of times too, William, is people think about mindfulness as I have to sit there and meditate.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. You can do it on the move. You can do it. You can do it doing what I like to do. I like to mindfully run and I like to mindfully walk. You know, I find both of those fantastic. But can I just go back to what you were saying about those little steps? I think that's so important, right? Because when people, one of the kind of bad thinking that people have, one of the kinds of bad thinking, is that people tend to, I think, when they get stuck in the world, the picture's too big, and they start to think, well, and they jump ahead of themselves. Oh, I could never be happy because I could never be a movie star, or doctor, because I could never move to New York, and I could never train, and I can't drive, and I can't, until it works all the way back into I can't do anything. And actually, if you start from this end of the problem, which is how do I get to New York? Can I get in my car and start driving and worry about the rest when I get there? Taking that first step, one step at a time, man, that's the biggest one that there is. That's the biggest hack that there is in the world, because you don't even know where you're going. You know, halfway to New York, you meet someone fantastic and reroute to Chicago and do something else. The most important thing is to get the hell out of your house wherever you are and live. You can't get it right all the time, but wrong is always better than, you know, being stuck.
I agree. Can you walk through some of what your experiences were as you were coming out of your depression, or your what you were being affected by? Sometimes I don't even like to give it titles, right? We're being affected by something, and what that was like for you as you were coming out of it, taking your first steps right on the sidewalk or wherever it was that you walked or ran, and kind of walk through, you know, because I can see you starting to experience it, right? And then this idea starts to come, and, you know, kind of walk through what your experiences were.
Yeah, I mean, so I was trapped in a flat. I didn't want to go out. I felt strangely not just depressed, but very scared. You know, I felt that everything had been lost, and that I had nowhere to go that could possibly make any sense. And everything like that. When I rang up my friend, who's actually American, who's a poker buddy from here in London, and you know, he was not a natural choice to be a runner, and neither was I. You know, we, along with poker, often come some other bad lifestyle choices, and we had most of those covered as well. So it was not an easy choice to go out, a natural choice to go out running with him. But I'll tell you what, we did 50 meters the first day. We both appreciated being there for each other because he was going through a divorce. He's now divorced from that woman. That sense of having somebody to talk to who who's, you know, who's understands you, wants to hear you, and taking it in turns. And I mean, I always liked him. He was somebody you could talk to easily. That's not necessarily the case with everybody, but there was something. It's a walking side by side, which is massive, right? We've all been on road trips. You'll open up to just about anybody on the back of one of the, what do you call those buses in America?
The Greyhound.
Greyhound, right. You'll open up to just about anybody in the back of a Greyhound at midnight crossing over the Mississippi state line, you know, particularly when it's cold and you're wondering where you're going. That person on your left, you know, who smiles at you becomes your new best friend.
Yeah, I think that's massive. I believe I read through it. That's part of what your exercise or your setup is here is also, I like the idea of having that running buddy, that person that you're doing that with. And is that part of the dynamic running therapy?
Yeah, so you can, if you follow my book, which is called Running with Mindfulness, you can do it for yourself. There are programs for running with depression, anxiety, anger, all sorts of different things in there. But I also show you how to do it with somebody else, and ideally somebody who's got their own story they're going through, or maybe it's even a similar story to yours. So that teaches you how to do it. There's also in my TEDx talk, which is called Movement is Medicine. In there, in the second half of that, there's another pairing up thing, which I'm very proud of. I call empathy runs, which involves just this very simple process of buddying up with somebody, and you take it in turns talking. One person talks for 10 minutes, one person listens for 10 minutes. But the important part is that you're not interrupted for 10 minutes, which is unheard of in this world. And it's very important that the person that's listening does nothing to sort of try to save, solve, interpret. You're there merely to share the journey with them. I don't want the person that's sharing to feel like they've now got to worry whether this person feels that person's got to look after them and so forth. And then the listener reflects back to the sharer and says, I heard you say that, you know, life is tough. It's one sentence. Then you swap roles. But it's that process of being on the road together, sharing 10 minutes uninterrupted, and just feeling that, you know, that this is a place that, you know, I always say to people, make sure that you do it with somebody that you feel comfortable and safe with, because it's surprising how much can come up. You know, once you get started and you've got all that silence, you could really, so don't do it with your boss if you don't know them very well, or your neighbor if you can't trust them, because God knows what might come out. Do it with somebody that you trust, or somebody you don't know even, maybe.
Well, I think that's huge. I mean, one, when you're going through things and learning to listen to other people too, it can help take you out of yourself. At least, even if it's 10 minutes, you're not thinking about yourself. And I think you said something so important that you're not trying to fix them. You're not running going, oh no, they're having it bad, so let me do it. Nor do you want to get caught with the person that's just hoarding the run the entire time and talking, and you don't get a word in, that you're putting an actual structure to this.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's why there's the reflecting back piece at the end of the 10 minutes, where you just, because that way, you know, you better listen to them, and you better practice some listening.
There's a quiz at the end of this.
Listen, hey, what's the cognitive rampage? What does that actually mean?
Well, it's a short one. To live enthusiastically, to question the world with an enthusiasm, to question yourself, others in the world, in a search for competence, knowing that there is no truth, but only the truth that I believe that creates the narrative of my life.
Seriously, did you just read that off something, or have you said it so many times? I love it.
No, man, that's really just in the dome, man. I, you know, a thinking rampage is, you know, I wrote this. My therapeutic approach is called the Transrational Structure Behavior Theory, but you can't sell a book that. And no. When I first came out, I was pissed, man. I was so mad at the treatment facilities, what people were receiving. I was angry. No. And so I was talking with this anger, with this rampage. And it's kind of what it's about. And when you're trying to pull yourself up out of the hole like that, man, and like yours, take that first step and get out. You got to roar. You got to come out and go, I'm running today, you know, and fighting it with that. And, you know, we believe our truths, our lives to be fact. you know, and what we think isn't necessarily true. Our feelings certainly are not facts. And we tell that narrative every day, you know, my story's this, that, and the other. But the example I opened the book with is like, look, William, if you rode a roller coaster and you told me it wasn't scary, I rode it and I said it was, who's telling the truth? So if we can start there and go, I can question my own bullshit, my own story, that own narrative that I'm telling myself, my woe is me shit. If I can question that, then that's a place I can start and question the reasons I'm depressed. And well, I kind of put all those things to a structure is what transrational structure behavior theory meant. It was bringing in, like you did, cognitive practitioners, behavior, biology, you know, sleep, nutrition, all of these things that, you know, play a key role in how we evolve, man. And for me, when I started doing this, it was about bringing people like you on that have their own cognitive rampage, their own story, their own reason, their own fight. And so I like to keep going with the interview until I see the person I'm interviewing, they snap into that flow state that Kotler writes about, you know, that flow where you're just really doing it for that reason.
You're getting me all worked up over here.
That's it, baby. That's it. It's game time. You know, that's what it's about, man. It's what it's really about when, you know, people look for happiness. And this is just a state that we create by what we're choosing to allow ourselves to feel. And, you know, enthusiasm is something I talk about. And if we can be enthusiastic about our own lives, about our own story and changing that story, you know, I tell people, if you had a shit life and you make it somewhere, wow, you now respect yourself. If your life was easy and you made it to that same place of success, you wouldn't even respect yourself. So thank God you've been through the shit you've been through, because now your story's interesting. You know, it's a comeback now, you know?
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I think a big piece of it is just as you said, it's that existential piece. It's understanding you're the author of your life. And the best part of that is you can change any beliefs that you have when you want to, adjust anything you need to, ideas you have about yourself. I've had a great few years, last sort of 3 or 4 years, and I've also had some tough ones. I lost one person very close to me, actually two people one way or another, and I turned 50, which actually was a good thing. But I'll tell you what I've come to believe is that I've been through enough crap in my life, and I actually really don't want to waste any, my belief that I have for myself and the world I've chosen to live in is that I don't want to waste any more time wondering what ifs and wasting moments about doubts about who I am. I am who I choose to be. If I want to be strong, I'll be strong. If I want to think I'm an idiot, I think I'm an idiot. Guess what? I choose not to think I'm a total idiot. I'm a bit of an idiot. That's okay. And you know what? I don't care how much of an idiot I am, because my focus is on other things. So the bit that I am an idiot, that'll have to be okay. My focus is on making the most out of my life and enjoying it. But it did take, I'll be honest, it took a lot of different things to get me to this place. I feel great today, but I had to, you know, have that meltdown I talked about 13 years ago. I had to lose one or two people close to me, and I had to get to a certain age where it was just like, guess what? There isn't an infinite amount of time left. I'm 51. I'm in the wheelhouse right now. It's a great place to be. I'll be sort of 60, 70. I'm not going to have the same kind of drive then. Right now, I'm at a sweet spot where I've got, you know, I can run a marathon in the top 10% of the people that show up. That's without barely training at all. My brain works well. My health is good. This is a sweet spot of personal power, experience, health. It probably doesn't get much better than this. So I'm making, what's the expression? Making fire while the wood burns, or whatever it is.
Yeah, man, that's what it's like. I mean, I've written two books myself, working on the third, but when you're writing a book, I tell people, well, they go, I want to write a book. And I'm like, look, it's a lobotomy. You know, for me, it was. And what was your experience like trying to put the dynamic running approach together and fix that Rubik's Cube to the right places? What was your experience like writing?
Well, you know, not so easy, because, of course, when I was doing it up first, I was just combining regular integrative therapy with running. Then I added in a mindfulness piece, and then I started getting interviewed a little bit about it in newspapers. I started having to talk about what it was. Now I'm putting it into words, and then it leapt into theory as I sort of found all the what research there was that sort of backed up what I was saying. But mostly I did a sort of cognitive trick, which was just to tell myself to keep my expectations low and my drive high. I knew that I had a right to write this book. I knew that I knew more about it than anybody else did, which didn't say very much. I was the only one person doing it. So, you know, as long as the book captured some aspects and was useful to a percentage of the people that read it, I was happy with that. And it was my first book. I knew I wasn't going to write the Gutenberg Bible. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't going to be War and Peace. And it's not War and Peace, but I hope it's written in a language which is really accessible and talks a lot about, you know, loving yourself, treating yourself decently and learning how to intervene with a cruel inner dialogue and making a little bit more gentle and useful.
Yeah, I certainly can appreciate that fact and trying to put that out there to help some other people and yourself along the way. And can you walk into maybe some more specifics about some of the practices that one is to do while walking or running or partnered with or just some exercises?
Okay, so the book is made up of different parts. It's got the guides on mindful running, guides on mindful walking. And that's just, do you want to know what mindful running is or how that works?
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
So if you go for a mindful run, all you're really doing is as you are in all mindfulness, is you're replacing sort of cognitive rumination, going around in your head, worrying about yesterday and planning for tomorrow and later on. And instead, you're deciding, I'm going to come back into the here and now. And the here and now is a physical place. So you ground yourself using an anchor. For some people, they use their breath, they count. If in sitting meditation, you'll try and count to 10. But it works like this, whether you're running or sitting or walking. Mindfulness, and I know you know mindfulness, but for any one of your listeners who doesn't, the trick is not in can I count to 10? And if I only, because each time you think about yesterday or you drift into what you've got to do later on, you've got to restart your count. So you might only get up to 3 and then you're back to 1 again. And you're just like, damn, I've just done it again. I'm back to 1 again. And the skill is not in trying to get to 10. It's not to be that person who gets to 10 every time, because you're just never going to be that person anyway. The learning comes through how you get better at greeting that person who says, damn, I can't get past 3. I can't get past 4. Because the world is full of all sorts of counterintuitive rules. And one of them is that the more unpleasant you are to yourself, the more of a problem it continues to be. And if you say to that guy at number 3, oh, it's okay, don't worry, you know, just you know, start again, you'll get there at some point, you'll make it to 10 next time. If you jump on him, you know, you're going to be stuck at 3 for some time. So you've got to be nice.
Yeah, right? Keep rolling, brother. I'm all ears right now.
Okay, well, so that's a practice. While you're running, you're going to count your breaths, and each time you get back, if you do make it to 10, then you go back to 1. You can count your footfalls, you can count trees, you can count anything that can be counted. Some people don't count; they just concentrate on the breath, the sensation of air coming onto their body, which can be very pleasant. Smells. Sounds, trying to identify various sounds. So that's a mindfulness piece in there. Then you've got these various programs I mentioned for running with depression, running with anxiety. There are about eight of those. And those are come with an introduction at the beginning of the chapter on how we understand depression, for instance. And then I ask the client to, or the reader, to run with 20 different questions all around depression, all around what your expectations are of yourself in the world, what your experiences are in the world. And through running with that question, hopefully you gain a lot more wisdom about yourself. And then you write it in the book at the end of each question. So you end up with this long narrative of getting to know yourself better and getting to treat yourself better. And that takes you through most of the mental health pieces. Then there's the empathy runs I talked about in my TEDx. What else is there in there? There's running with your kids, programs for running with your kids, which I'm a big fan of. Not that I've got kids, but if I did. But I love to watch other people running with their kids, my favorite thing. I love to watch families running together. Do you have family? Do you run with them?
I have an adopted daughter. She's 19, and she's actually in your neck of the woods right now. She's over there studying abroad.
What's she doing?
Well, from what I see by Instagram, nothing.
Good. That's what you're supposed to do when you're at college.
Yeah, she couldn't wait to get over there and do that. But she played volleyball for a while, and I used to work out with her and lift with her and teach her some martial arts, some things we do. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. There's these two young kids in my subdivision, and now they got to be like 7 or 8, man, like young. And they come by running in tandem, I mean, dressed like they're in the New York Marathon, you know, and then they'll stop and hit their watch and do the thing. And I'm like, dude's in a, but he's a banker already. Look at him, man. Like, they're getting their run on. They're like literally 6 and 7 doing their thing. We're busy playing kill the man with the ball, you know, much less running and watching my heart rate and things like that.
It's kind of scary, isn't it? Yeah, they'll probably go a long way. I hope they'll be happy along the way as well, not pushing themselves too hard. But yeah, it's interesting to see that, isn't it? You've got to wonder what made those kids want to get out there and do that the whole time. But that's got to be better than sitting playing Call of Duty.
Anyway. Yeah, for sure, man. You know, when you were talking about the mindfulness practice and during running, I think that's really helpful for those dealing with depression, et cetera, because when you are, you tend to drift off into how sad or shitty everything is or how bad you are. And like you mentioned earlier in this podcast, when you go into a workout like that, you come out of it almost even worse or through it even worse. You know, I do a lot of heavy bag and boxing and all. And if I start boxing on that thing and I'm in a bad mood and I'm banging it out, I may even wind up in tears, you know, as I'm swinging on that thing. And using the mindfulness practice during that running, it does really allow you to kind of clear your thoughts and kind of almost focus on something and finish something. And I can see at the end of that run, no matter how long, you kind of went, hey, I just went, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 5 minutes without thinking about the and ruminating about all of the things I've typically been thinking about.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I mean, mindfulness is great for depression. You know, there's a guy called, have you ever heard of Matt Haig?
Yeah.
Matt Haig, he wrote a book on depression, and it's got a long list of things to do to keep yourself busy when you're depressed. Because when you're depressed, you can get so overwhelmed that you just sort of sit there unable to do anything. And for me, what I like to do when I'm feeling down or I'm feeling powerless, they tend to go hand in hand. I like to do something that I'm good at and something that I can see the result of. And quite often, call me crazy, but what I'll do is I'll clean my home. I'll get the old vacuum cleaner out. I'll clean it. I love to get some services going. And I get lost in that. You know, I get lost in the doing. And I'm no longer in my head thinking about stuff so much. Maybe I've got some music on. Another one is ironing. I like to iron my shirts when I'm depressed as well. Because I put on some radio, I put on a podcast or something. And I, you know, I've made a commitment just to, in that moment of to keep busy, or to do self-care, and I know that actually if I commit myself to it, I don't drift off, you know, because I'm there. I've decided to do this thing, and it's feeling good, and it's the exact opposite of what I was feeling, which is stuck and doing nothing. And I'm relieved to no longer being stuck doing nothing. I'm so pleased to be doing something that I just stopped thinking that stuff, you know.
Yeah, I think that's why you choosing to use running is or even walking is so key, because, you know, so many times people that are in that situation, they're like, ah, my life, it's too complicated to be that simple, right, to make it any better or fix anything. And so many times it really can be that simple, right? We just make it more complicated because it's our shit, right? Yes. So, you know, the idea that you use walking and running, I mean, you can get out and walk and do that, and then incorporating such a structure, a mindfulness structure, and those things, man, it's so much more, is what I'm trying to encourage the people that are listening either now or will listen when we move, when we upload this to iTunes and the podcast and all, is that there's a structure to this, that there's practices, that there's steps you go through literally and figuratively, that it's so much more than just that, man. I like the simplicity, but also the structure to it, that there's a reason, a rhyme, an application, and something we can do with ourselves. You don't have to go to this complicated therapist or read some complicated book like The Cognitive Rampage, right? You can get out and apply these methods on your own with no harmful side effects.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things people get worked up on is this idea of what am I going to do with the rest of my life sort of thing. If you keep it in rehab, what do they say in AA? They say keep it in the day, keep it in the moment as one or the other. Because guess what? In this moment right now, normally you have everything you need. You're alive, you're warm, you've got a meal. Yes, tomorrow might be crap or it might be fantastic. Who the hell knows? But if you keep on projecting forward to the point where, you know, there's uncertainty and you decide to focus on the worst case scenario, then you're bound to end up feeling shitty about the world. In running, we call it run the mile that you're in. Don't worry, maybe you'll crash out in the next mile. Who the hell knows? But this mile, you're okay. Just run the mile you're in.
Woo, you're getting me hype, man. And it's true. You know, I think maybe, I don't know, I'll process this with you, is, you know, I think maybe due to evolution, however you want to think about it, right? However we got to this, that we used to be so movement oriented, right? We're growing our food, building our houses, or defending off lions, right? Or saber-tooths, whatever it was, that we were so active. And in today's modern world, you know, we're on phones, on screens, you're at the office, you're in the car. That we don't move that much. And it seems so simplistic, but when you really think about the idea that maybe, you know, evolutionarily or biologically or neurologically anyway, that we're actually programmed to move so much. And when we don't have resistance. And when we don't have resistance, our mind then has to fucking create resistance.
Yes.
It has to fucking create something that we have to attack, which is usually ourselves. Right. And then we're like stuck. And I mean, I remember when you come out of a workout or a run, when you bust your ass, you're too damn tired to be depressed.
Yeah. And you know, if you're out there doing stuff, you got a job, you know, you go out there, do a square work at your job, bang some nails in, whatever it is you do, use your body. If you have a job that uses your body. And then come home, not only do you feel like you've achieved something, you see there's a roof on your house now. You feel a sense of achievement. You've used your body. You've been outside. And when you get home, you feel great because guess what? Now you don't have to do anything but just sit there and relax. So sitting feels great and doing feels great. Now contrast with that somebody who doesn't do enough. So doing doesn't feel great because all I'm doing is pushing paper around an office somewhere. And then when I get home, I got all this nervous energy from being the person that doesn't really do anything I really want to do. And it's not really physical enough either, because all I do is drive to work in my car. Now I've got all this nervous energy. And just like you said, I don't have anything to do with it. I've got nothing to do. So now I'm going to aim it at myself. And I'm just going to let it run around my head like a mad rabbit, causing mayhem until I'm, you know, an anxious mess.
Or I'm road raging on somebody, or I start drinking to try to calm it out. It's pretty vicious, man.
No, we've got to use the body. Go on long walks. If you're lost and depressed at this point in your life, get a dog. Find somebody else who's got a dog. Go for walks in the morning with your dogs. Or even if you don't have dogs, find a walking buddy. So you get up early. You can hear those birds. You can use your legs. You can walk for 2 hours a day. A lot of depressed people do that. Just get moving. I know it's really hard at first. Get moving, get your body going, do some things in the world. And after a while, things will pick up.
Yeah. I think we're inundated so much, right, William, with like a diet and exercise will save your life, right? And you get hit with it so much until you literally actually do it and you go, holy shit, this kind of works.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, man. And you know, when we don't move like that, and look, I've had both sides of the coin, right? I mean, the first business I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. The first business I had, I was an auto detailer, and I did mobile. I had some shops open when I was real young, helped me put through college before I realized selling drugs made me a whole lot more money. Before I did that, I did that for a while. And so when I would detail all day, either in the sun and sweat, you know, I would come home and I couldn't wait to get my cerebral on, whether that was read a book or do something, you know, outside of that. And then when I became a therapist for a little while, I would lose my mind, not only because I'm sitting still all day listening to other people's issues. I would come out of that and I'm home going, what am I going to do? You know, I got to do something. Then I have to do physical and I'm at the gym packed in there with like rats with everybody else at 5 o'clock trying to get on my hamster wheel, not going anywhere. You know, when outside is where I wanted to be. Do you make that differentiation between running, you know, on a treadmill inside versus running outside?
I do, but not enough that it would actually stop somebody from running on a treadmill inside. I mean, for God's sake, if that's the only running you're going to do, do it. But no, I think outside's much better. It, for so many different reasons, you know, you get the phytoncides from the trees, all the chemistry that comes from the trees and reacts with your microbiome. You get all the fresh air, you get the vitamin C from the sun. But also I think an uneven, and you get all the socialization and the entertainment, which I think is better outside. But perhaps the most important bit is, for your body anyway, is the bit where you're on an uneven surface when you're outside. And I think that's much better for you in terms of keeping your balance strong and your knees and these sorts of things. And other people would say, no, it wears your knees out, get on a treadmill. I don't know. I'm not a physiologist, but I think if you're in a park or something with just a little bit of uneven, that's got to be better than just thumping on a springed treadmill. It just seems to me. So you talked about resistance there. You know, this is why I was listening to a podcast yesterday, all about resistance and resilience in kids today, and why they are so anxious and having not experienced enough resistance in their lives. I'm not sure that bouncy treadmill is giving you enough resistance. I think you need to be out there thumping on the tarmac.
Well, and much less, you don't get to, like you, I think you mentioned earlier, you don't get to finish. There is no A to B except a little number, which you can change in your own head, right? You're like, all right, I'm going to run to that 16th mile. And then you're like, 10's okay, right? You can just back it down. But when you run away from your home somewhere, you're like, I got to get back. You know what I mean? There's that A to B kind of feeling, that resistance. And you spoke right on point about the microbiome, the sun itself, what we're breathing in, you know, how we bring that into our body, how that's important, the air you're breathing. Because I've been in enough gyms and I don't want to breathe that nasty dude next to me that's running like that either, you know?
Sure. Yeah, with sweat flying all over the place, it's not great, you know. Tell me, so what, how many podcasts? 232.
223 today with you.
223. What have you taken away from the previous 222 podcasts? What's your big takeaway? That's a big question, right?
Yeah, I wish I could recount all of the wonderful people that have come on and shared their stories, their philosophies, their experiences, their competence. You know, it's all up in there somewhere where they talk about it. But, you know, I think maybe a takeaway from so many different avenues and people I've spoken to is there's so many options to take care of you, that there's so many different ways to do so. That one, we can get inundated, right? Where I'm supposed to do this at 9 o'clock. I'm supposed to be in bed at this time. I can only eat at this time. I got to fast this long. I have to get sun this way. I have to put myself in an ice bath here, right? I did a post on my Instagram where I did the Drago from Rocky IV, and yeah, he's got all the things and bells and whistles plugged in on him. And I ranted about, you know, just jargon people use today. And I'm like, there, now that I've done all that, I can go back to living my life. You know, that we can be inundated with that we forget to just live our own life, you know, that's out there. But, you know, there's just so many ways and options to take care of you. And I think we forget about that so easily.
Oh, man, we do. You know, there are so many things we can try right now. Whatever city you're in, whatever town you're in, there are classes for everything from musical theater to African drumming. You can decide to pick up a cookbook in a secondhand store for $1 and cook everything that's in it. One new meal every night. That'll be fun, right? That's entertainment. If it's, find somebody else to come and join you, invite other people around to try your new food. So you can become a cook. You can become a drummer. You can write the great American novel. You can start hiking up mountains around you. You could learn Italian in your spare time on an app that only costs $3. And what the hell are you doing sitting around wondering what to do in the world? The list goes on. Oh, there's never been a greater time to be alive, right?
Oh, I would so agree with you, man. There's actually the part of my book at the end, I call it the personal life inventory. One of the principles I talk about for change, right, is CCE principle, that competence brings confidence, confidence brings enthusiasm. And in that personal life inventory, you kind of write down things that's under the I column, what you're interested in, things that you're competent in, things you're confident in, and things that you are enthusiastic in doing. And enthusiastic basically means you have all underneath that. Competent means, yeah, I know about it. I could probably give a lecture on both sides, argue both sides, but I'm not so confident because I haven't had enough experience. And some people, brother, all those things you mentioned would be like, ah, I don't like any of that. I don't know what my passions are or what I'm enthusiastic about. And I tell people, look, just write down something you're interested in, even just a little bit. You saw it one damn day and you're like, I'd like to try. You write that down. And then to feed that one day, you put into your behavior, your routine. It's like, you know, I'm going to try that little bit. And the more you try that thing a little bit, you get competent in it. And then that competence can also make you confident that it doesn't make you enthusiastic, right? But at least now you know, right? And trying those things. And when you do that, you realize, holy shit, I can paint. You know what I mean? You find some stuff that, you know, you didn't know you could do. I do stand-up comedy too. That's something I thought I could never do until I just wrote down a bunch of shit, tried it one time, and had a decent, you know, I had my first bomb though last week. Holy shit, did that hurt. And it hurt real bad.
Remember the joke that you died with? I want to hear it.
Oh, well, the whole set bombed. Oh, yeah. Yeah, dude, the whole set bombed. It was terrible. Like, it hurt. Like, I came home contemplating, like, holy shit, I'm a terrible person. It was awful. But, but I didn't know. You know, you don't know until you try something, till you get out there. I hear people, like, well, I don't run, or I can't run. I'm not a runner. And I'm like, dude, until you literally go and do this, take some mindfulness practices, you know, from your book and from the things you talk about in your TEDx talk. Try that until you follow a little interest and experience it. You can't confidently say that you're not a runner.
And stop setting the bar so high, like everything you try, you've got to either enjoy or you've got to be good at. I mean, if you do that, just go and try stuff. Whoever said you have to be good at it? You know, try it out. Some of it you'll be good at, some of you won't. So what? That's it. That's life.
Yeah, I think that's imperative, man, especially the younger generation, right? They're just, I don't want to pigeonhole them either, right? Because I have my own moments. But, you know, it's they're expecting to be this somewhere hidden in them, this LeBron James, that, you know, this Picasso somewhere in them. All they have to do is find that thing. And the minute they try it, they're going to be an expert at it. And they'll go, this is what I was born to do. When I'm like, no, man, you got to fail. You got to be crappy. Like, you got to bomb like I did last week. You know, you got to be terrible at things. And then through that struggle, right, that adversity you face is how you begin to get better at it, I think, and learn that, hey, it is or it isn't for me, you know.
Well, if you watch a pro, I mean, I've got a window open right now on my computer with Bill Burr on it. Do you like Bill Burr?
My fucking favorite, dude. He's in my top three of all time, man.
He's my number one. But, you know, Bill Burr didn't become Bill Burr overnight. You know, he got out there and he hustled and he screwed up here and there and he hit some hard audiences in little small towns. But it just made him want it more, and it made him angry, and it made him funnier. And, Bill Burr.
Oh, I love that dude. I could probably quote half of his stuff, man. He's a killer. And there's so many different, you know, we're talking about comedy, but there's so many different avenues, you know, and personalities and character to different stand-ups and what people fit with, you know. And I always urge anybody, there's a private group that we run on Facebook called the Tribe of Change. And it's these are just some beautiful people of a support group. Everything's free. I don't ever charge anything. We just hang out. And I encourage everybody, go live one time, no script, don't do your fucking hair, don't change, don't think about it, don't go to bed that night thinking about what topic you're going to talk about. Just randomly click on your phone, go live and go, hi world, here I am, and talk and make your palms sweaty because you're nervous as shit about it, right? And just go live one time and just see what happens. Don't worry about the likes or the comments. Please don't read the fucking comments. You know, just go live one time. Test yourself on something that you thought you never could do or you had to prepare to do.
Yeah. Well, that's what I did with my TEDx. Scared the hell out of me. I don't mind telling you. And you can even see it if you watch a TEDx. There's a moment halfway through where just like you, I absolutely dropped the ball. I was like, oh my God, the worst thing has just happened. I've just lost everything. And I'd rehearsed it so many times. I knew where the paragraphs began. So I just jumped to the next paragraph in my head. And I missed out a line or something like that. But, it's there forever now on YouTube. But I feel great that I challenged myself to do it. And I know that it's contributed to me feeling stronger and being better. And, you know, the next one will be better if there is a next one.
Yeah, that's wild that you did the TEDx talk, man. I've talked to kids, thousands of kids at once. I talk into things, but man, being on that TEDx stage in front of some of those greatest minds and trying to stick to a script and say something, man, I give it up for you on that one, brother.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Well, doing comedy, I'm sure it's not easy either. Do you ever, who after Bill Burr is your favorite?
Probably George Carlin.
Oh, old school.
Yeah, George Carlin's up there. Just, I mean, most people would say he's not the funniest if you like the slapstick kind of shit, you know. But for me, when I get cerebrally stimulated and I laugh from the back end, like, oh, shit, you know, that he writes so well. And plus, the dude put out a special every year. You know, I mean, kicking out one a year like that, I mean, that's murderous. And, you know, he talked about the day that we were in and before a lot of other comics, you know, but before the Lewis Blacks and people showed up, he was doing the political stuff. He was talking about things that made you really go, oh, shit. You know, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, no, that's true. Good comedy is a beautiful thing.
Oh, it certainly is, man. And bad comedy is a hilarious thing to watch, too. I'm telling you, man. I did so poorly the other time. I did the first bit. Threw out the third bit real quick because that was my go-to. I'm like, this shit always makes somebody laugh. Threw that one out there, and I got crickets, dude. And as I went into the third bit, I'm realizing I'm bombing as I've just bombed with these two bits. I got through it so fast, I forgot the last two punchlines to the last joke. I was just like, I'm fucking out.
Well, when you don't believe it anymore, you know they don't. You might as well get off the stage at that point.
Oh, it was terrible, man. It was terrible.
So do you ever get heckled? Have you been heckled?
I have before, but it's usually some overly explicitly drunk woman, and I can't yell at them or play back because you never know where that's going to come to, you know, so I'll mess with them in the crowd. But for the most part, I go up, right? Because look, I'm going to switch to this character real quick because it's really me. I'm a little hood, man. I'm a little thug, right? I kind of came from an old street place around here, and that's how I live. So when I'm on stage, I'm being that guy. You know what I mean? Truth be told, William, I have to concentrate to make sure I talk this way when I'm talking regular, and make sure I'm not like, yeah, man, this shit's crazy as fuck, dude. You know, and so I'm full on that guy when I'm on stage. So some people are a little more hesitant. You know, I'm talking about drug dealing and crazy shit I used to do. It's not the guy you really want to heckle.
So, but tell, you know, I'm interested to hear this piece about why you don't want to challenge the female heckler. You know, apparently we're all, you know, the male and the female, we're all on the same page now. I mean, we've got to cheat each other, right? But there's no, I hope you're not patronizing them. Is that what you're saying? Are you patronizing them because they need special treatment, or are you scared of them? Which one?
I'm scared of them because you lose either way. If I say something shitty, it's like, you know, it's like beating up a kid or somebody that's way smaller than you, right? I always fought the bigger guy than me because I win either way, you know. So the woman in the audience who's messing with me, one, she's usually wasted. And if you say something, now I'm yelling at a woman, right? I'm being mean to her, you know, for the most part. And you come off of there kind of like, ah, shit. And I might have to fight her bigger than me badass husband later. You know what I mean?
No, I think you're right about that. Yeah, there's not a lot of upside in that, is there?
No, not at all, man. And what's weird, though, I will say this, to differentiate the sexes, is it seems that drunk women are more likely to heckle, and then they keep heckling. They don't shut the fuck up. They just keep talking like you've invited them to be a part of the show, and now they're just want to be in the show and they don't shut up. So if you acknowledge them, I think it invites them to continue to do it.
Right.
Yeah, I'll get emails for that shit, man.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, man, that's a tough one getting that right.
Yeah, it's rough, man. But so what's on the horizon for you, man? What you working on now? Where you think about what are you thinking about heading? Where are you quotes running toward now?
Oh, I like that. I like what you did with that. That's good.
What I did there.
That's sharp, man. That's sobriety for you. I would like, can I come and move to Florida? How does that sound? I come back to Florida.
Yeah, come on, man. It's freezing here, like I said, because it's 50. So it's freezing here right now, but anytime. Although, if you listen to a lot of comedians, we are certainly the butt of a million jokes that we live in Florida. They must be in Florida and all this other stuff. And I'm like, I start to get offended, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, I'm like, this is it ain't all crazy. But then you turn on like some live PD or one of those old cop shows, and you're like, shit, it is always Florida.
Yeah, yeah. So my plan is to. You know, I've got various things that I'm doing with my business. My big dream has always been to break America. That's my dream and remains my dream. I'd like to do what I do in America. I'd love to have a podcast like you one day.
I'll help you out. Whatever you need to do, and whatever tips, whatever you want, man, I'll help you out.
That's a fantastic offer. I might have to take you up on that. So I've got I've just submitted a new book to Penguin. So I'm hoping that's called The Final 5%, Making Peace with the Tough Stuff. It's a book that helps you make peace with all this stuff. You try to ignore shame and guilt and stuff like that. It's a better way of dealing with that. And then having made peace with it, it's all about powering up into your authenticity, because now you're, you know, an unapologetic person. You're okay with who you are, the asshole, the idiot. All these pieces have now, they've all come home, and you're comfortable having dinner with them. And it's like, oh, there's my asshole. Oh, that's a bad choice, actually. Let's say, there's my idiot. So they're all there. And now anytime you meet anybody, you're like, hey, here are all my friends, and we're all going to be here having dinner with you as well. So I believe that gives you an enormous power. I've seen it in my clients. I've seen it in myself. It gives you energy. It gives you authority. So the book is really, yeah, I'm seriously excited about it. And I'll find out soon whether Penguin are going to buy it or somebody else buys it. Hopefully it'll be a big hit in America. And I'll come and meet you, and maybe we'll do a podcast in person. And then I'll, you know, just get massive.
Man, I don't want to get too massive, because then people give a shit what I'm searching on the internet. You know, I don't want to get known at all, man. It's if I can help people and do it and make a little money at it, then great. But you're welcome here anytime, man. You come crash at the house, man. It's I live in a mansion. No, I'm just kidding. But you're welcome to come crash.
Right, man. You got your own fire there, or is that a television?
It's a fire we put inside the wall.
Okay. Well, check that out.
Gangster. Yeah, gangster, man. It's what's the name of the book?
So the book that I've got at the moment, that's out at the moment, is called Running with Mindfulness. You can get that anywhere on Amazon or wherever else. The new book, the working title on it, is The Final 5%, Making Peace with the Tough Stuff.
I like that, man. Would you consider, because I self-published both of my books. I got a couple offers for the second one, and I don't know, I felt like an independent rap artist, where I'm like, I'm not signing any big label. You know, they seem to want a lot. Is that the route you want to stay going?
It is. You know, my dream is to be somebody like, do you know who I mean by Brené Brown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Brené was invited on the podcast not long ago, before her book blew up, before she wound up on Tim Ferriss and yeah, messing around with Oprah. And then all of a sudden she's like, yeah, no.
She must have seen one of your stand-up routines, I think. No, but I love Brené, and so no, I would choose to go with Penguin. I would choose, you know, I like to scale up, because I love what she's done with her career, and I'd really like to have a message that goes out there far and wide. That would be the more people I could touch, so to speak, the better.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm just going to leave that comment out there. I was going to mess with you for a little bit. But
I could see it in your eyes.
Kind of like seeing your asshole, right?
a little bit like that. We'll leave that there, I think.
Yeah, man. But I like that title of the book, though, because there's a lot of unfinished business, you know, as a therapist refer to it, that we don't deal with, that we leave to the side. Right. We think, all right, we're back working again. You know, we're dating again or in a relationship. Right. We're doing those normal things again. And so many times we leave that to go a little young on you, that dark passenger, that shadow. Right. That we don't pay attention to, that can still hold you back over time.
Oh, so much so. You know, I always think of it as stuff on your shoulder, and we deal with all the easy stuff first. And then that last 5%, you know, you just either try to ignore it and you try to fix it. You think, well, don't worry, I have 95% of it's okay. I got this stuff covered. But actually, I think that it ends up kind of poisoning everything, doesn't it? When there's this kind of no-go area, it's full of shame, and it comes to visit you in the middle of the night. It visits you, you know, throughout the day, one way or another. You know, you need to make peace with this stuff. Bring your friends around for dinner, the one I was talking about before.
Yeah, I would agree, man. We tend to definitely leave some stuff. We're back on the horse riding or whatever. And you're so correct, man. I think it does weigh us, and it poisons over that long period of time that I just don't go there. You know, a PTSD person may say, I just don't like to talk about it. And you just shove it down in there like an old Irishman, and we don't say anything about it. And we drink it away, right? That we don't pay attention to those things, man. And anything we can do to, I know Penguin's going to pick that book up and put it out there, and anything we can do to help that book get out there, The Rampage, we're here for you, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've had me rampaging during this this podcast. It's a powerful podcast. You should have told me that. I would put a seatbelt on just here, you know.
It can get pretty intense, man. You know, since we started this, I'll give you a little tip. When you start your podcast, depends on where you want to get the viewership and stuff from, is we bring, you know, satellite people in like this on YouTube, Google Hangouts, which is a great thing to do just because Google looks for information. They have certain bots, because this entire podcast is transcribed on Google's back end. And so if people are searching about running or mental health, it'll pop up more than likely. Plus, it houses everything for free. But we don't drive all the traffic to YouTube. We've never tried to. The only link we ever share from YouTube is when we share that we are live to come on. But other platforms do not help out the YouTube link at all. So what we have done is driven all traffic to the iTunes feed that we have put in almost 4 or something years ago. And yeah. Driving it there has certainly helped. We finally crossed over the 100,000 download monthly. I don't know, threshold or speed bump, brick wall. Took a while to get there. And, you know, you just keep like you'd probably tell somebody with running, right? You just like, I call it hashtag gumping them, you know, like Forrest Gump. You just keep running. You just keep recording. You just keep putting stuff out there. But I always encourage everybody to drive all the traffic to the iTunes feed it right from the beginning.
Okay. That's interesting. If I do start a podcast, I'll do that. I'd have to think about, you know, the thing that always worries me, to be honest, and I still haven't quite worked this out yet, is how do I talk about my work, talk about what inspires me, talk honestly about who I am without affecting my work with my clients? Because quite often your clients will Google you. You know, mostly they find you on the internet to begin with. They punch your name in there and up comes everything you've ever done. Do you know what I mean? And then they're going to see me on Cognitive Rampage, they're going to press play, and you know they're left with a certain impression of me, which may a good impression, exactly, one which may or may not encourage them to hire me. It's not so much whether they hire me or not that worries me, because I don't mind living my truth. What worries me more is the ones that decide to hire me, having thought that they've learned these things about me and understood certain things about me. What worries me is that some of them may jump to a conclusion that never gets entered into the room. You know, most of us therapists, we like to be a blank slate, don't we? We don't want our clients knowing too much about us. And yet, outside of the session, I think there's no limit to how much they can know. I don't know. I still haven't worked it out. I've got a female therapist called Petra, whose podcast I did the other day. She's like, listen, don't worry about it. Just say anything. Don't bring it into the session. But what they know about you outside of the session, the life that you've had, the things that you believe, if it's important and they want to bring it into the session, let them. But, you know, you don't have anything to hide. You shouldn't have anything to hide, and just live the way you want to hide. But, you know, live the way you want to hide. What's oh, dear. Live the way you want to live, I mean.
No, I think I would certainly agree with her and encourage it. And from a therapist argument, is the number one thing that we have to build as a therapist from the very beginning is trust, right? Yeah. And I used to argue, because they love to throw around that term countertransference, is, you know, I'm doing therapy through my client if I'm talking about myself so much. And I agree, there's a line there. But outside of that, to build trust, I think it's hilarious to a point of sadness where we ask a client to come in, divulge everything about their lives, their deepest, darkest thoughts, and we tell them nothing of ourselves. And so somehow we're supposed to build an authentic trust between a person that they don't really know us from anybody, and we don't share anything. They don't know anything about us, and they're going to tell you about those deepest, darkest thoughts. I always saw it as more of an opportunity to say, hey, here's who I am. This is the person I am. I'm either human like you. I have experiences like you. And because I'm open just like this, well, now you're sitting in a session with me. I'm doing it to the whole world. I'm just asking you to be open, honest, and real with me in this room.
Yeah. Well, I think the traditional model is in traditional psychotherapy or psychodynamic psychotherapy, that that blank slate is supposed to trigger useful anxiety in the client. So they, you know, on session three of you not saying anything and them not knowing anything about you and them revealing themselves, they suddenly scream out at you, you know, you bastard, I've tried so hard here to be, you know, and I've given you everything, you've given me nothing, at which point you reflect back to them and you say, oh, I hear you getting very, very upset here. Do I remind you of your father? You know, is that the transference? That's why I don't work as that kind of therapist. I'm a very different kind of therapist. But at the same time, I think you can build, I build trust with my clients, I hope, by being present, by having unconditional positive regard, and by being congruent, which is kind of what you're talking about. It's about being truthful to who I am. And I think I can be truthful to who I am without referring stories back to myself. I hope that people can see from my start to where I'm sitting, my availability, the truth of who I am. And, you know, I did have somebody the other day ask me a very personal question about my past, and I chose to answer it. I didn't go into detail. It was just a simple yes or no question. Has this ever happened to you? And I said, yes, I know a fair bit about that. And that, and I left it at that. And I felt good. I felt that I'd made the right call on that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Freud is, you know, one of my favorite, the psychotherapy aspect and some of those things. You know, I thought he was just a wild man for back then, when everybody's thinking it's something to do with demons or something like that. And he's like, nah, it's because you want to fuck your mom. You know, I mean, you got to have some serious oomph to say something like that. And to walk into it, I thought he was amazing for that. And but linking everything to that and psychotherapy, I get it, in the blank slate and to do so. But try to, when you're trying to help someone that's dealing with addiction and they go, well, have you ever battled with anything like this? And you're like, well, no, but I've read about it. Well, you're done. You've lost all credibility for the most part right off a rip, you know.
Or worse still, you say to them, look, this session isn't about me, it's about you.
Oh, right. And then they're like, hey, right, so you want me to tell you all the, right, the darkest things? Look, there, I don't think there's any perfect approach. You know, there's a reason why I don't practice anymore. I could not continue to practice within the insurance structures and what I'm supposed to say and do or that way, because I'm still watching a 2% recovery rate, a 98% people or recidivism rate. And I'm going, well, what you're doing sucks. So I'm going to push back. I would push back. I would seriously bring up confrontation, push people to those edges, I think. And, you know, I like I said, I don't think there's any right way or wrong way. There's certainly wrong ways, you know, but I don't know. I think to each his own, and those people that fit with the therapist fit and that approach. And I think, just for me, being yourself out there like that, I think what you'd more or less do is reel the people in that are looking for that kind of therapist, the person you put out there, as opposed to a person they're not sure who they're going to.
Yeah. And you know, I if anybody ever says to me, do you think I should go into therapy? My answer is normally no, you know, unless you really feel like you need it, because it's so hard to find the right therapist. You've got to find the right therapist who you like, and they've got to then have the right approach. And then you've got to work together well. So now you've got three different variables, and you're going to go out there, and what does everybody do? They go and they hire the first person they meet. And when it's shit, even though there's got a 2 out of 3 chance that it is going to be shit, they just go, well, it must be me.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible, man. Most people quit. You know, I think it's like a 30% chance. They've done numbers and research to it. It's hard. You know, you just can't stop. I like what you said, though. Unless, you know, you think you need it, you know, don't walk into it, because you certainly can open up some doors you didn't mean to open.
And perhaps the most important piece is if you're not sure you need it, but you want to try it anyway, then just make sure that the therapist you settle. So research shows that the what you've been referring to, the therapeutic alliance, the quality of that relationship between client therapists, is the single most important variable. It's much more important than the approach you take, whether you decide to talk too much or too little about yourself, whether you're a blank slate, a Freudian, Adlerian, whatever you may be. The most important thing is, do you click with this person? That's what's going to make the biggest difference. So don't, my advice to anybody thinking about this is, do not choose the first person if you don't feel you've got a good energy. Now, it may be that you're being extremely hostile to them, which is why you don't have good energy. And that's understandable. First time I saw a therapist, I was incredibly hostile. I noticed that he had 2 mismatching socks. And I was like, what kind of idiot has mismatching socks? How's he going to be able to take me on? And I came like a lot of people did, highly defended, thinking that this was some kind of intellectual joust as he got to know me and his ideas outpowered my own. You know, a lot of people begin there. And just anybody who's listening, you know, that's fine. If you've got to begin there, begin there. But give the guy a break at some point, because it's your money, it's your time. And it's not about being, it's not a joust. Don't make it hard for your therapist. Make it easy for them. It's your time. You know, you get out what you put in.
Yeah, man, that's beautiful. I like that. That's a heck of a little cognitive rampage there, brother, to end our little session with, man.
Yeah, I feel great that I finished it there, because see, I know that at any one time there are a lot of people thinking about therapy. So if I just set somebody off on a better path, that's a fantastic moment.
Yeah, man, I'm sure somebody listens and say, you know what, I have been an asshole to my this therapist, and those are great thoughts for somebody to think about, man, and also to do while running, man. I'm circling it back there. I think it's such a simplistic way to start with one foot in front of the other, but for people in depression and dealing with those things, getting out of the house can be one of the hardest things to do, and going outside and starting with them there by, you know, teaching them to use their behavior to change their thoughts, and then working in a lot of the therapeutic approaches that you have with it. I love the idea. I love dynamic running therapy, the idea of that. And I'm certainly looking forward to that last 5% that you're going to write here and release here soon, brother.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
All right, man. Tell everybody where they can find you, Twitter, Instagram, buy the book, all that fun stuff.
Okay. So the book is called Running with Mindfulness. You can find it in all good bookstores and on Amazon, of course. My website is dynamicrunningtherapy.com. My Twitter is @PullenTherapy. There's a TED Talk called Movement is Medicine, William Pullen, and that's Pullen. And then there's also an app which does much of what the book does, which is free, all of it, which is called Dynamic Running Therapy, IOS.
Beautiful, man. I appreciate you being on the Cognitive Rampage. William Pullen. I almost said doctor just to mess around with you, man. Thanks
for enjoying myself. Thanks, man.
Thanks for running through this with me, man, and covering everything with us. Thanks, brother.
Cheers. Yeah. This for all my people that grew up being told that they would be dead in the penitentiary by the time they were grown. And then you wonder why they got depression, self-esteem, anxiety issues, you know?
After so long, you start to believe it. I recall everything I was told. Boy, you never lived to be 18 years old. Dead or incarcerated just like those people who wander down similar roads. Leaving out the house, you say, please don't go. Granny, why you stay trying to save my soul? If death is my destiny, like you had said to me, let me get busy before he gets the best of me. Don't you know bullets don't have no brain? And a lot of youngers don't have no aim. Am I living or dying? Somebody please explain. Go understand, because I'm going insane. I'm strapped up cause he is shiesty cause she is. Meanwhile, dude who teach chemistry is in his office with a kid doing shit I get expelled for, which makes me wonder why people go to jail. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up. I'm a kid peeping injustice, y'all, let's slide. But you're so quick to point out mine. That's what made me draw that line. Blinded by my own design. I'm doing fine. No, I'm not, I'm doing bad. But I'm so afraid to talk. Y'all got shit going on. I don't wanna bother y'all. Pause cut from a different cloth. Never be the man he was. Thought I was slow, I turned out to be a genius. And I ain't returned like eat my peanuts. Let our bank statements be the difference between us. If I seem distant, bitch, I'm 30-something. I was supposed to bend up, been a murder victim. My grandpa prayed till his knees gave way. If he can't save me, God, please save Jason. The way I went in, that's the only explanation. I know some bad dudes, enough to know I ain't. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up. I was confused, and you can hear it in my rhetoric. In retrospect, I never should have made it back. I wrote my senator and never got a letter back. My friend Chris got killed for a Cadillac. My man Mike died for a powder pack. So understand why I could think that I was next. Under attack, guns and crack. Or the motherfucking police shoot us in the back. And they think it only happens to blacks. And refuse to believe it almost happened to Stack. Stabbed in the back, blood beaten through a heart filled with crack. Soldier up, fought through that. Injuries, a lot of players don't walk off. I walked off, cause I ain't the type to walk off. If we family, you supposed to love me when I'm wrong. Be a man and represent me when I'm gone. Stones in the foundation get looked over, but without them, the whole damn house fall over. This is for the rocks that exist beneath me. The block which gave me a pass to be me. BBs are baby bullets, babies are in training. My people were banging before they called it banging. Just chilling, hanging, words exchange. One thing led to another, all I heard was. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up. Even if I did die young, so nobody expected me to ever grow up. Grandmama lectured me, you better grow up. But there was no telling me I wasn't grown up.